This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When it comes to Mideast oil money these days, the $7 billion Dubai ports deal, now giving President Bush so much trouble in the U.S. Congress, is a drop in the oil barrel. Surging prices for crude oil are turning the glittering cities of the Gulf oil states into new Xanadus. An ocean of Gulf oil money is buying an ocean of products and properties around the world and floating an ocean of American debt. It is also financing Iranian dreams of nuclear power and Islamic fundamentalist dreams of world power. Later in the hour, we'll go to Capitol Hill for more on Congress crossing swords with the White House on the Dubai ports operation deal. But we start in Baghdad for a look at the emerging U.S.-Iraq-Iran, maybe axis of instability, if we can call it that. Borzu Dargahi is Baghdad correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Borzu, thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
I have to go first to the situation just there in Iraq. Secretary of Defense Don Rumsfeld saying reporters are exaggerating what's going on, and your interview with the American ambassador there seemed to be no small part of that. I want to ask you about that, Borzu, but let's listen first to Secretary Rumsfeld.
From what I've seen thus far, much of the reporting in the U.S. and abroad has exaggerated the situation, according to General Casey. Interestingly, all of the exaggerations seem to be on one side. It isn't as though there simply have been a series of random errors on both sides of issues. On the contrary, the steady stream of errors all seem to be of a nature to inflame the situation and to give heart to the terrorists and to discourage those who hope for success in Iraq.
Borzu Dargahi, you quoted the U.S. ambassador there saying the American invasion had opened a Pandora's box. We want to get balanced on our perception of what's going on. Is there an exaggeration of the instability in Iraq? Are things better than Americans may be thinking?
Well, I mean, I'm not going to get into the sort of red state, blue state kind of debate. I will say that a lot of people here, including U.S. officials, have for many months quite candidly expressed, real worry about the situation here. And what you had with Ambassador Khalilzad is sort of, some kind of fresh, frank talk about what's going on here. He wasn't saying it's time to pull up the stakes and get out of here. Mm-hmm. On the contrary, he was saying that because of the situation here, it's time to really redouble U.S. efforts in terms of making sure that that we leave behind a sort of stable government, decent government that can prevent the region from convulsing in an even larger conflict.
In the last few days, we've seen some very large numbers of gruesome dead. Meanwhile, Iraq is trying to get its new government together. Where does that stand? That's been delayed. How long, how soon might there be a new firm government?
Well, I would say it's going to be at least a month or two. This has been going on for a while, this sort of political backroom shenanigan with the sort of debates that are going on and like the horse trading that's going on. It's no big deal, actually, in my assessment of the situation in terms of the government starting or not starting. And it's no big deal primarily because it seems that what happens inside the U.S. protected green zone, which is the big, huge area that's in the middle of Baghdad that is where most of the administration of Iraq takes place, doesn't seem to have that much impact. It doesn't seem to really translate into what happens in the rest of the country. These guys, some of them very sincere, some of them very talented politicians and technocrats, can do their thing in the green zone. Meanwhile, outside, many other things are happening.
Now, Borzu, I want to look at how the Iran factor is playing in here. And there's an Iran-Iraq relationship. There's also, of course, the global concern over Iran moving allegedly toward nuclear weapons. There's been a lot of exchange lately on this. Let's listen first to Vice President Dick Cheney at AIPAC warning Iran on nuclear weapons.
Of course, this matter may soon go before the UN Security Council. The Iranian regime needs to know that if it stays on its present course, the international community is prepared to impose meaningful consequences. For our part, the United States is keeping all options on the table in addressing the irresponsible conduct of the regime. And we join other nations in sending that regime a clear message: we will not allow Iran to have a nuclear weapon.
Meaningful consequences and all options on the table. Then, of course, yesterday, Iran responding that the United States, too, can feel pain and harm. U.S. officials saying those aren't all pilgrims coming into Iraq from Iran. What's the dance that's going on here, Borzu? Does stability in Iraq depend on Iran? Can the U.S. punch Iran up on nuclear weapons and still count on it staying out of Iraq?
Well, I think there's a bunch of different things that are kind of interrelated and complex and sort of overlaying each other that are going on with regard to Iran, Iraq, and the U.S. To a large extent, you know, Iran has had, you know, centuries-long ambitions on Iraq, especially southern Iraq, where you have these very important Shiite shrines like in Najaf and Karbala. They've had designs on that part of the country for a long time. They see it as their near backyard. They see it as part of their sphere of influence. And so they see this sort of current vacuum as, you know, and they don't see this as an evil thing to some extent. They see it as their kind of responsibility to come and help out the Shiite brethren, so to speak. You know, but then, you know, you have a few other sort of things that are at play. On the one hand, you know, the U.S. and Iran are engaged in a very recent sort of Cold War, a 25-year-old Cold War, and Iraq has become the battleground for that. And so you have a situation where, you know, the U.S. uses what's going on in Iraq to apply pressure on Iran, and Iran uses what's going on in Iraq to put pressure on the U.S. And that takes many different forms, you know, and, you know, what we saw with the rhetoric yesterday was, I think, just that, you know. I mean, maybe Cheney was trying to raise some funds, you know, given the forum that, you know, he was speaking at and the upcoming elections. And so, you know, he's giving red meat to the people he's trying to raise money for. And Iran, similarly, too, they're trying to kind of, you know, give some red meat to their hardliners, give some, you know, support to their hardliners, and so they come out with this threatening statement that the U.S. is going to feel pain. I have a feeling that behind the scenes, according to Khalilzad even, there are, you know, modalities of meetings being discussed and a way to find a diplomatic solution to this whole nuclear crisis.
Hot language. We'll hope it can cool off. Borzu Dargahi in Baghdad, thanks very much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Borzu Dargahi, Baghdad correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Our big story this hour is the new Mideast oil boom. We're going to follow the money. You can join the conversation. Which ways do you see the new Mideast oil money cutting? Toward peace or toward trouble? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm joined from New York by Peter Coy, senior economics writer for Business Week and co-author of the magazine's cover story this week on the new Mideast oil bonanza. Peter Coy, thanks for being with us.
Hey, Tom.
Tremendous money flowing here. Describe to us just how much the coffers have fattened as a result of the crude oil price surge in the last couple of years, Peter.
Well, just last year alone, the Middle East oil exporting nations made about $320 billion on exports of oil to the U.S. and other countries. And because oil is sold in dollars, almost everybody who buys oil, even if their dollar is not their own nation's currency, spends dollars for it. Just enormous river of dollars pouring in to these countries, and they have to do something with it.
Peter, just the photographs in your magazine this week are kind of eye-popping. That Dubai skyline with the tallest building in the world going up there and all that super lush new construction underway, it's just amazing. Paint a picture for us.
It's gorgeous. I'm looking at the picture now myself, two-page spread showing Dubai in the evening, all these buildings glowing gold, and then you have this sail-shaped building in the rear. And then what Dubai is building now is El Burj, which is going to be the world's tallest building. They're not even telling us how tall it's going to be. They're just erecting it in secret. And they're up to 30 or something floors now, but they claim it'll be 40% taller than anything else.
Looks like a giant sail. The whole scene looks like a picture from a different planet almost, a richer planet. It's a different path the Gulf states are on this time than in the last oil boom. What's the difference?
The difference is, this is critical. I'm glad you asked me that question, because in the 1970s, you remember, these countries were not even really countries. They were loosely speaking, kingdoms, but actually just tribes, so almost semi-nomadic tribes in the desert. They did not know what to do with all the money. They didn't have the infrastructure to handle it. So what they did is they just fast and furiously passed it off like a hot potato. They put it into international banks, and they put it into special treasury securities in the United States because they didn't know what to do with it. Mm-hmm. And what they did, the money they did spend very often was wasted. There were, cement would lie on docks and get wet. Food would spoil. Product would be brought in and rust.
And now?
And now they're much more sophisticated. They've learned over the past three decades how to spend and how to invest. And Dubai happens to be the prime example of a highly developed economy. And they don't want, Dubai does have oil money, but they happen to be the exception in the Middle East of being probably the most diversified economy. They're trying to build really almost like a tourist and information and trading economy. The other country, Saudi Arabia, of course, being the prime example, the biggest oil exporter, have not gotten that far in diversification, but they are more sophisticated in investment, and so less of the money is being wasted this time around.
Peter Coy, I know I've only got you for another minute. We're going to look at the security implications of this, but on the economic front, give us your bottom line for the world economy. Of course, there are many other economies that are feeling the oil boom, and from Venezuela to Nigeria, anybody who's producing oil. But this is the heart of it. For the world economy, what is the bottom line of Gulf states booming at this rate? Of all the money pouring in there, is it good? Is it bad? Is this good for the health of the world economy or not?
The United States, it was reported this morning by the government, posted its biggest trade deficit in history in January, and a lot of that was oil money. It's not good that the United States is running an enormous deficit while other parts of the world are running enormous surpluses. It's a recipe for instability. That said, it's better that the oil states spend it than that they stash it in banks, causing banks to make stupid loans the way they did last time around to Latin America. So actually, I feel a little better about the situation than I would have if we were still had the primitive infrastructures of the 1970s.
All a little wiser, but still a kind of a bulge and not necessarily a healthy one from the U.S. debt side. Peter Coy at Businessweek magazine, thanks very much for bringing us in here. Thanks a lot for joining us.
All right, thank you.
Joining us now from Washington, Fareed Mohammadi. He's a partner at PFC Energy. It's a consulting group. He heads the country risk group at the company. Mr. Mohammadi, thanks for joining us.
Hi, how are you?
We're very well. And joining us from Dubai, the city-state in the United Arab Emirates, Yusuf Ibrahim, Managing Director of Strategic Energy Investment Group, a political risk consulting group there, formerly a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Before that, for many years, a correspondent for the New York Times and Wall Street Journal. Yusuf Ibrahim in Dubai, thank you for joining us.
Good evening, Tom.
Yusuf, first to you, in Dubai, if you could just paint a picture for us from, you know, you're sitting right there in the front row. What does it look like to see this oil boom exploding in Dubai these days?
Well, that sail-like hotel you were talking about a minute ago is actually a hotel, probably the most expensive hotel in the world, called Burj Al Arab, which has, among other things, a seal supported by 24-carat gold beams. I am sitting here looking out of the window, and what I see is a cross somewhere between Los Angeles and Disneyland, with a touch of imperial Albert Speer architecture. Some of the buildings here are simply superb, others sort of in bad taste. But it's the ultimate free enterprise haven of the Persian Gulf and of the Middle East. This is a city-state, and you have to look at this demography. 90% of its population, an estimated 1.6 million people, are expatriates. So for all practical purposes, it is a city-state that's under benign foreign occupation, but the benign because the people who are here to make money. Nobody here can or wants to do politics. So it's a mishmash of things. It's not quite Singapore because in Singapore, in the end of the day, you have a majority of the people are a native population. This is a new paradigm, Dubai. And in that sense, it is a very interesting paradigm to look at.
90% expatriates, 100,000 of that 1. Some million Iranians. Politics, open politics, maybe not permitted, but all kinds of subterranean politics going on. Fareed Mohammadi in Washington, just look at the region's own economies for a moment. Peter Coy was saying it was kind of a bust the last time. A lot of money came in the first oil boom, didn't really turn out to build sustainable long-term economies there. Have these countries learned? Do you see them building economies that may push toward economic and maybe even political stability on the back of this boom?
I think so. I think the bust of the 80s and the 90s taught them quite a few things. I think that the current success, yes, is definitely underpinned by high oil prices. But I don't think that was enough to get the whole region to boom the way it has. I think government actions in terms of stabilizing their budgets, oil prices helped, but they also took a lot of actions to, in a sense, restore macroeconomic stability. They also targeted, and Dubai was definitely one of the leaders in this and showed the way forward, learning from Singapore and the Asian economies that government can intervene in certain sectors and then create the right conditions for private sector to move in. And this is what I think the new phenomenon is, that the private sector has started to repatriate a huge amount of capital into the economies of this region. And that's partly has become a force multiplier and has led to the economies growing quite rapidly. I think that needs to go on for quite a while, and certain types of sectors need to be sustained. Petrochemicals in Saudi Arabia, business center, tourism in Dubai and some of the other places. And that may start to lead to a self-perpetuation of economic growth.
Very hot economies. We've seen here stock markets up in Egypt up 1,000%, Dubai up 770%, Saudi Arabia 710%. These are big numbers. And yet we read Tom Friedman, the New York Times columnist, saying, you know, all this oil money is a big problem. He's pushing environmentalism, saying America, go green. It's the new red, white and blue. This just supports authoritarian petrolism, his phrase. What about that, Fareed Mohammadi? Does the greater flow of cash into the Middle East encourage reform and stability, or does it encourage the old guard to dig in the middle of their sort of platinum-plated, you know, fortress?
There's no doubt that oil money in general supports more authoritarian regimes around the world, not only in the Middle East, but around the world. Having said that, let's put some things in scale. Mm. Firstly, the purchasing power of, if you discount the oil revenues by imported costs and also the exchange rate effects on, as you were saying, it's all in dollars, but they purchase about 55% of their imports come from non-dollar countries. And since the dollar has been quite weak, it impacts their purchasing power.
Right.
That purchasing power has actually only reached 1985 levels, which is just before the last decline in oil prices, just last year in 2005. So they've just been crawling back from the hole they dug for the last 25 years. So I just want to put things in perspective a little bit, that this oil money is not, in terms of the world economy, is much less than it was in the 70s. You haven't, and as a result, you mm-hmm. haven't seen the crashes, the external shocks that rocked the world back in the late 70s, early 80s. So I think that Friedman and others are a bit shrill about this issue of oil money.
A significant impact, but maybe more manageable in terms of its scale this time around. Yusuf Ibrahim, I want to come to you on that, but let me invite our listeners in as well. Gray's calling from Lexington, Massachusetts. Hi, Gray, you're on the air.
Hi. There's a reason why both my wife and I have hybrids. I'm very worried about oil money going to the oligarchies of the Middle East. I mean, usually when we choose trading partners, we choose people that sort of believe in our same ideals. And I'm really worried about the radicalism of the oligarchs that are getting, you know, a large percentage of the oil revenue that we pay at American pumps.
So where do you see the big money heading? Do you see it heading toward peace if these economies develop, or something else?
Well, I don't think we have a choice, right? I mean, I think that we're not the ones choosing the peace. I mean, it's obvious. I mean, Osama bin Laden, obviously, is from Saudi Arabia. His family was in construction, but I'm sure their money they got was from American money, from American pumps, American oil, and I think American oil money, excuse me. But so no, I think it's going to radical factions and good factions. But there's no choice here. We don't, you know, the money goes to whoever. You know, wherever they want to. So if the oligarchs want to spend it on radical factions, they can.
Tom Friedman says the ultimate long-term choice is the one you've made, I guess, Gray, is to try and get off the oil. Yusuf Ibrahim, let me put it to you. How do you see all this new money intersecting with Middle East politics and with Islamic fundamentalism?
Well, Tom, getting off oil is easier said than done.
No kidding.
I fear we have entered a new paradigm here, and I have written a number of articles calling the 21st century probably or possibly the oil war century, because we finally reach a point where there simply isn't enough of the stuff to go around, and two-thirds of the oil is here in the Persian Gulf region, all around us in Dubai. Hence the import of Dubai as a observation station here. Now, we really have not come up with a substitute to put in your car. And until we do, for the next number of years, probably 6-7 years, the price of oil is going to stay above 50 and probably continue to climb into the 60s and probably the 70s.
Where does that drive Middle East politics? Where does it drive Middle East conflict?
Well, here is the other element of this new paradigm comes in answer to your question here, which is that these, call them whatever you like, banana republics, oligarchies, whatever, are coming onto the global economy. Now, the Dubai World Ports deal, for example, was this tiny little Dubai stepping onto the globalized economy. And when you play in the globalized economy, you have got to have some kind of shared values. So it is not, and you saw the clash that happened over Dubai World Ports immediately. It happened because any number of congressmen, think tanks, intelligence agencies, and so on and so forth, in other words, a nation like America, which is a nation of multiple institutions and multiple voices, it is not a perfect democracy, but it's not a banana republic either, and it works more often than not. Many voices came up to oppose the president of the United States, who made a deal with the ruler of Dubai. You don't have these values here. Here, it is basically this entire enterprise, it belongs to one man, who is the ruler of the United Arab Emirates, Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid. He is admittedly very intelligent, very smart, very agile.
Sheikh Mo.
Investor. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Sheikh Mo, as we call him. But it's still a one-man show.
Yusuf Ibrahim, you said that Dubai is a den of Iranian spies, money laundering, the Russian mafia, an autocracy, a sole ruler, no constitution, no democracy, no rule of law, no transparency whatsoever. So is there a shared language, whether around the Dubai ports deal or beyond? I mean, how do the politics play out when the economics is embedded in that kind of political setting?
Precisely. You have to have... People have to play by the same rules, and if we're going to play in the global economy, we have to have something called transparency. In other words, I have to know, where is your money going? In Saudi Arabia, for example, one-fifth of the gross domestic product is consumed by 22,000 Saudi royal princes. There is no accounting for that money. It's going, you know, a prince is born to the royal family, and now there are 22,000 of them. He gets a stipend, and that could be as much as $3-4 million a month. Now, this prince, if you have 22,000 of them, probably one quarter of them may have Islamic fundamentalist tendencies. That's where you see the money seeping out of the system and going in directions which threaten the, in this case, of course, the security of the Western world or the security in general of those regimes.
Does that mean they're writing checks for bin Laden, that they're sending guns to Iraq?
There's no doubt in my mind that some checks for bin Laden are still being written out of this part of the world. Then across the Gulf here, you have Iran. Iran is not a Mickey Mouse country. This is a country of 70 million people. Mm. It has gone through two major wars. It has a huge shoreline on the Persian Gulf. It has a considerable and important army. And it, more important than that, it has loyalists and people who follow it among the Shiites of Iraq. 70% of Iraq are Shia. In Bahrain, almost 80% of the population is Shia. In Lebanon and here in the United Arab Emirates and in Kuwait and so on and so forth. So Iran is not a tiger that without teeth. It has teeth and it can bite. I'm not saying it will bite, but I'm saying it's a dangerous, fragile, and turbulent area. It shares absolutely nothing of the kind of democratic values we have. Mind you, I mean, we should not get transported about the United States. Yeah. We have a lot of corruption in America. Mrs. Clinton is opposing the deal while her husband collects $1 million from Dubai every year.
For consulting to Dubai. Fareed Mohammadi, we just got a few seconds before the break, but do you see Iran emboldened on its nuclear weapons path by oil wealth? Is it that kind of connection?
Not so much the oil wealth. I think more the failure of the United States in Iraq.
Right now, Alex is calling from Franklin, Tennessee. Hi, Alex. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Very well. What do you think?
I think there is an imposed responsibility that needs to be for the. I'm from the Middle East. I'm originally from Iraq. I think that need to be shared. I think there is a missing responsibility that just because the Gulf countries have the oil revenue that it's theirs to spend the way they like.
What do you mean? What are you suggesting? What should they do?
I think there is so much poverty in that area. There's so much class difference. The middle class of the Middle East is almost a negligent when you look percentage-wise.
Right.
So we need to spend the money wisely. I don't think we need Burj Al Arab or this and that.
You mean the big towers, the gold-plated...
Mm-hmm. Sorry?
You say forget the big gold-plated towers, platinum-plated, let's spread it around. Let me put that to Fareed Mohammadi. Fareed, is that happening this time? Are these governments looking at populations that got pretty restless when times got tight in the early 90s and saying we have to invest this in our own people, our own countries this time?
I think that they have gotten that message. They got it very clearly in the mid-90s. And I think that they have tried this time around to institute some both fiscal and general economic policies to try to improve the economic conditions. There have been, I think it is the economy, stupid, is the slogan in the region, from Iran to Saudi Arabia, and they are trying in their own way. Now, there are excesses. There's the sort of Las Vegas, Fantasyland, Disney World of Dubai on the one hand, but go through the region where there are real population centers. I think that the governments are trying now to develop their region. It's not going to be a simple task. It's most certainly not going to lead to an eradication of poverty in many regions, in many parts of the region. I want to say one thing, though, that the stability that has come, the macroeconomic stability and with it the political stability, has really, I think, is an improvement from the 90s. If you didn't have that, you'd add to the chaos that is going on in Iraq. Imagine if that was going on that scale in Saudi Arabia, and you can imagine the impact on the oil prices and that impact in turn on the world economy. Finally, it has given the governments of the region enough funds to invest in the future oil sector, to improve capacity, to increase capacity so that we can have fairly stable prices going forward. So I think that there's a positive side to this, the increase in oil prices and the increase in revenues to the region.
Some advantages there, perhaps. Yusuf Ibrahim, I want to get you to hear you on that, but first let me turn to Mohammed, calling from Vienna, Virginia. Hi, Mohammed. You're on the air.
I just had to put this oil flow money in perspective. In fact, most money that is generated from this excess price increase goes to domestic U.S. producers. You know,
we saw those huge profits at Exxon and elsewhere.
Exactly. The domestic producers of oil and gas get the money more than the Middle East. In fact, only I believe 20% of U.S. oil imports come from the Middle East. The rest of it pretty much comes from our own lake, whether it's from Maracaibo or from Alaska. And having said that, also the other factor is I'm not so sure we're talking about stability because all this money is flowing in. These ruling autocracies are the most selfish and the most racist societies in the world. And a lot of their wealth is based on exploiting South Asian and other laborers. There's no rule of law there. There's no rule of law whatsoever. And it's a grossly exploitation. I frankly wish that the South Asian countries would take over these little shakedowns and shake the place down.
Whoa, you want to really shake the chessboard there, Mohammed?
I think they're the most greedy, selfish, racist bunch of people around.
Mohammed speaks for all the South Asian maids working in Saudi Arabia and the guys working on the oil rigs. Mohammed, thanks for your call. Yusuf Ibrahim, what about it? The connection between the oil money, political stability in this region, autocracy, for that matter, the U.S. democracy project in the Middle East. How do you see these swirling together?
Well, they all mix, but the mix is flammable, I fear. The situation on the ground is not as rosy as it seems in Washington, with all due respect to my colleague there. In order for the money to flow and to do some good, to increase productivity, it has to flow into channels that are dominated by people who can say what they want. But there isn't, in the absence of democracy, of any representative democracy, basically what happens here is what the top man wants. And in the end of the day, it becomes the expression of a megalomaniac dream.
But they don't want to be overthrown. Isn't fear not pushing them, if nothing else, this time to try and get some stability by spreading the wealth around?
Greed and fear are contradictory sentiment, and greed tends to overcome. Most of these countries feel there are no substitute to them. Of course, the Shah of Iran felt that way until 1979, and then he was replaced. But the regime that replaced him continues to feel the same way, that there is no substitute to it. A free choice comes from a boiling of a cocktail, a soup together, and this is not the case. Over here, all this oil money that's coming in is being spent. That's true. It's being spent on promoting the so-called welfare state. So you see that the standard of living is actually rising, but productivity is not, because the people of this part of the world are not working. If you take Saudi Arabia, there's 22 million people live there. 8 million are expatriates, and they do all the work. The Saudis hardly work at all. I mean, they're 90% or 95% of the public sector is staffed to Saudis. The same numbers exist in Kuwait and in Qatar and here in the UAE. I mean, 80% of the country is run by expatriates. Mm. Only the top bosses are. So that is not what I call a distribution of wealth. A distribution of wealth is something that provokes, that brings up the best in a country, that takes your citizens up in the food chain, and then makes them a productive entity. That is not happening. The people who are running this show basically are us, foreigners.
So a learning curve, but maybe not a steep enough curve. Vijay is calling from Burlington, Massachusetts. Hi, Vijay, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
A lot of the Middle East oil money flows into the madrasas, that is the Muslim boarding school.
The madrasas, yes, where?
Yeah, the madrasas. And my concern is mostly for South Asia. Like, we have seen militancy coming out of those madrasas in Pakistan and Afghanistan. You know, the Talibans are essentially indirectly funded by the Saudi money oil, money from the oil.
Yep.
And, a lot of the militancy coming out of Pakistan, which spread to Kashmir, a lot of the terrorists were basically educated similarly in the madrasas.
So what's the equation here? More money, maybe more of that fundamentalist education. Let's ask Vijay, Farid, Mohammadi, what do you say? Do you draw that equation?
It certainly funded the madrasas back in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. And I'm sure there's still continuing. But I think it's more an issue of policy. I think that was a concerted policy by Saudi Arabia and different groups within Saudi Arabia, supported by the United States, to spread the Saudi brand of Islamic fundamentalism around the Muslim world, to win the hearts and minds. That has changed since 9/11 to some extent. I don't think that extra oil money leads to more Islamic fundamentalism. There are other causes of it. I think the invasion of Iraq inflamed the region much more than the increase in the oil price. In fact, the invasion of Iraq helped the oil price, but did more to affect Islamic fundamentalism. I think a lot of this is just sensationalist.
We've got war.
We have war
in Iraq.
What is going on in the region?
You know, we had 9/11. We have war in Iraq. We have Iran getting a nuclear weapon. Those seem like sensational headlines just on the face of it, do they not?
Right. So let's discuss the war in Iraq as a cause. Causal fact of instability in the region,
mm-hmm.
not oil money itself. In fact, oil money has been the stabilizing force.
What's the end game, the economic end game with the oil money, Fareed Mohammadi? I mean, part of the reason price is high is because it's becoming more scarce. So where does this region head in that century of scarcity?
Well, it's definitely going to inherit all the net new demand that's coming out of Asia. Certainly, it's going to accrue to Saudi Arabia. So I think that... But the Saudis are going to invest a huge amount of money to increase the capacity to meet that demand. I mean, that's that's what geology has done and blessed the region with. I think that consumers have to also act and say, I don't like this price, and then move away from using oil, as Yusuf said, that we should have a serious policy in the United States and other places to conserve and then move away from oil. None of that is done in a serious way. We constantly talk about Islamic fundamentalism and oil and bombs, etc. I think we need a serious discussion on what is really going on in the region and how we should move away possibly from oil. I think that's perfectly legitimate coming mm-hmm. from the consumer side. But I think that there are some more positive things going on in the Gulf than just mayhem and death.
Absolutely. Yusuf Ibrahim, should we be unbuckling this conversation of oil and fundamentalism, or are they inextricable?
I fear at this point they are inextricable. And for the next 10 years, we cannot move away from this region. Even if we lessen our dependency on oil, we have significant strategic interests in this part of the world. And as the sole superpower in the world, America cannot just take a vacation and walk away. This is kind of isolationism, is a fantasy. We have an interest not only in the oil here, but we have an interest in democratizing the area and moving it along, because the threat, in the end of the day, when you come right down to it, on 9/11, America was attacked by Arabs. And therefore, the Arab and Arab oil money is an issue that goes beyond the oil itself.
Well, we stare at that and more to learn here. We'll watch as the numbers rise. I'm grateful to both of you for being with us. Yusuf Ibrahim in Dubai, Managing Director of Strategic Energy Investment Group there. Yusuf, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And Fareed Mohammadi, partner at PFC Energy in Washington. Mr. Mohammadi, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
In a moment, a look at congressional action on big issues from ports to the Patriot Act. This is On Point. After a long battle with Congress that went down to the wire, today President Bush will sign a renewal of the USA Patriot Act. The Republican-controlled Congress gave Bush the narrow victory there, but it is breaking ranks with the president, it appears, over the ports deal. Yesterday, a House committee voted 62-2 to bar the Dubai Ports World Company from controlling U.S. port operations. Keeping a close watch on all these developments is Gail Shattuck, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. She joins us now from Washington. Gail, what's going on with Republicans on the Hill?
Well, they're in open revolt on the port issue right now. It has come to dominate just about everything that's going on up here, including a lobbying bill for which there was broad support is now stalemated over the ports issue on the Senate side.
Is the president going to be able to pull this out, or because it's been attached to the military spending bill, is there no way for George W. Bush to pull out the Dubai deal?
He's going to have to make a much stronger case to the public than he has made to date. That's what I'm hearing on the Hill. There are members I mean, you understand how unusual it is to see House Republicans in an open revolt with the president that hasn't had to veto anything since he's come into office. And when you talk to the Republicans especially, you hear almost the same thing. We are being overwhelmed with calls from our constituents who are outraged by what they understand about this deal. Now, there were two members of the Appropriations Committee to vote against it, Representative Jim Colby of Arizona and Jim Moran of Virginia. Both of them felt that it was wrong, it hadn't been adequately explained, but no one on the Republican side beyond those two seems in a mood to take the political risk of explaining something that seems so counterintuitive to the public.
Gail, is there a bigger context here? Henry Hyde speaking out recently about the democratizing project in the Middle East that the president has made so much of for the last couple of years, saying he's not sure, as I read him, that the United States can afford it. That's a pretty fundamental thematic critique of the president's line.
Hyde has been saying some remarkably eloquent things lately on the subject of the war, mainly around the theme that we are so powerful that we're not paying attention to evidence that indicates the limits of our power. He gave this in a broad speech opening a hearing a couple of weeks ago. And he felt that we need to tell the American people that to really democratize this region, we're going to have to do what we did in Europe and in Japan, which is be physically present there for many, many years. And that, he says, we're neither politically nor economically prepared to do.
So a bigger challenge.
And the public needs to know it.
A bigger challenge, but it's exactly what the president's proposing. What about on the Patriot Act, Gil? How did that finally unfold? How did the president get this? It was a narrow vote procedurally, I guess.
Well, I think that the Patriot Act vote, to my mind, is very similar to the NSA wiretap issue. In both sides, the president looked like he was pushing civil liberties, but for the purpose of defending the safety of the American public, his number one concern. There was pushback on a lot of fronts on the Senate side, interestingly from Republicans as well, but ultimately a deal was cut that conceded little, but basically gave the president what he wanted with the Patriot Act. The same thing looks like it's happening with NSA wiretaps. Remember the opposition when the New York Times first reported the existence of wiretaps without a warrant on Americans. Mm-hmm. But the more the president talked about it, the more he was able to get into public thought the idea, look, the people we're listening to are people connected with Al-Qaeda. We're interested in your safety. And that's what he hasn't been able to do with the ports. That looks like he's backing off concern for safety of the American public. That's why he's losing.
So get on the side of security, and ultimately it may still break your way, but it doesn't look so good on that line for the Dubai ports deal. Gail, thanks very much for your time from Washington. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Gail Shattuck covers Congress for the Christian Science Monitor. She spoke with me from Washington. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.